Hamlet Podcast. Hello and welcome to this exploration of Shakespeare's King Lear with me, your host, Conor Hanratty. King Lear is a challenging play. It's not quite as famous as Hamlet or as thrilling as Macbeth, but for my money, it might just be Shakespeare's greatest play. It's certainly bleak and intense and often horrifying, but like all the best tragedies, it demands our attention and rewards us with enormous catharsis at the end. The great poet John Keats knew well how difficult an experience King Lear can be, and even wrote about it. On sitting down to read King Lear once again. Oh, golden-tongued romance with serene lute, fair plumed siren, queen of far away, leave melodizing on this wintry day. Shut up thine olden pages and be mute. Adieu. For once again the fierce dispute betwixt damnation and impassioned clay must I burn through. Once more humbly essay the bitter sweet of this Shakespearean fruit. Chief poet, and ye clouds of Albion, begetters of our deep eternal theme, when through the old oak forest I am gone, let me not wander in a barren dream. But when I am consumed in the fire, give me new phoenix wings to fly at my desire. I can't promise to be anything like as good as Keats, but I'm excited for us to start this new journey together. During the pandemic, I actually directed a very abridged version of King Lear that was performed outdoors for schools around Dublin by a trio of amazingly intrepid actors. This will be a rather more in-depth look at the play, mind you. When working on Hamlet for the original iteration of this podcast, I was as strict as possible with the division of 20 lines of text per episode. On our more recent foray through Macbeth, it was a little looser. And now, for King Lear, there are some scenes that are so tightly knotted that it feels like a crying shame to cut them up for the sake of a few minutes. This is a play about chaos, in many respects, and so this will be ever so slightly reflected. Some episodes will be rather short, and one or two will be unusually long. But for the most part, you know the drill, and I hope you're going to come with me. So, King Lear. There are discrepancies even in the full title of this play. Check your own edition to see whether they call it The Tragedy of King Lear or even The History of King Lear. There are quarto versions as well as the folio version, and this play in particular seems to attract bogus stage directions from eager editors. I can't promise that I'll be checking everything that's in print, but I'll do my best to let you know of any really crazy ideas that I catch floating around. The play begins, Act 1, Scene 1, at Lear's court. The story was, like Macbeth, taken from Holinshed's Chronicles, wherein the story of a King Lear is set in the 8th century BC. Shakespeare, as ever, will adapt and change that story, and his version of this ancient Britain will be peppered with a good deal of contemporary detail from Jacobean London. We aren't given that much detail up front. Little more than that Kent, Gloucester and Edmund enter. Kent and Gloucester are both earls. Since they are not dukes, Shakespeare is immediately setting the play in the distant past. The first Duke of Gloucester was so named in the 14th century, so having an Earl of Gloucester already would have put the audience in mind that this was a story from long, long ago. The oldest dukedom, or duchy, in England was that of Cornwall, and the most recent, at the time that Shakespeare was writing this play, was the recreated position of the Duke of Albany. King James had very recently conferred this title on his young son, Prince Charles, in 1604. I promise we won't be getting too bogged down in the historical details as we go, but wait till you hear the first line of the play. Kent says, I thought the king had more affected the Duke of Albany than Cornwall. In a startling move, Shakespeare drags us from contemporary England back to ancient Britain. It's almost a funny joke for a character to be saying something like this. I thought the king preferred the Duke of Albany to the Duke of Cornwall. King James's older son, Henry, was Duke of Cornwall, and Prince Charles, as mentioned, was the Duke of Albany. Goodness knows if King James had a preference, but it is funny that Shakespeare might have suggested it on stage as he began this play. More importantly, what might the king in the play these earls are discussing prefer Albany for? All will be revealed. Gloucester answers, "It did always seem so to us. But now, in the division of the kingdom, it appears not which of the dukes he values most, for equalities are so weighed that curiosity in neither can make choice of either's moiety." Already we are getting echoes of that complimentary language so often heard at the Scottish court in Macbeth. This is a tricky line, so we'll break it apart. Gloucester says that he has always felt the king preferred Albany. It did always seem so to us. But now, in the division of the kingdom, it appears not which of the dukes he values most. So the kingdom is to be divided. This is a shocking line to start a play with, especially in the England of King James, that was all about unification rather than division. But the kingdom is to be divided. In this division, though, it's hard to tell who is going to get what. The two parties, Albany and Cornwall, are so equally weighed or balanced that there's no point even trying to guess who will get what. Equalities are so weighed that curiosity in neither can make choice of either's moiety. Moiety is an old-sounding word for a part of a share. More often than not, it means half of something, but as we'll soon see, the plan here is for three parts instead of two. As is so often the case in Shakespeare, Kent and Gloucester have come onto the stage in the middle of a conversation. They've reached the end of that subject, and now Kent acknowledges the other man who has walked in with them. He says, "Is not this your son, my lord?" It's a polite enough question, but Gloucester's answer is surprising. "His breeding, sir, hath been at my charge. I have so often blushed to acknowledge him that now I am brazed to it." Gloucester says that he's been responsible for the young man's upbringing, his breeding. But there's a sexual joke here, too, since Gloucester is also his father, so he was responsible for that breeding. But the young man is illegitimate. This play is already obsessing over heredity and legitimacy and parenthood, and we've only had four lines so far. Whatever shame that Gloucester may have in acknowledging this son has gone by now. He's so used to introducing him that he's not embarrassed any more. He's brazed to it. This is a very strange thing to say or to volunteer in conversation, and so Kent is confused. He says, "I cannot conceive you." Kent means that he does not understand, but Gloucester again makes a sexual joke. "Sir, this young fellow's mother could," whereupon she grew round-wombed and had, indeed, sir, a son for her cradle, ere she had a husband for her bed. "Do you smell a fault?" Kent just said the word conceive, and now Gloucester answers it, with the other meaning of the word, conceive as in conception, or becoming pregnant. He's saying that Edmund's mother certainly could conceive, and did so. She became pregnant and grew round-wombed and had the child. He jokes that she had a child for her cradle before she had a husband for her bed. This is strange enough to be talking about at court, but then Gloucester asks, "Do you smell a fault?" This is a very complicated line because fault had multiple meanings in Shakespeare's English. It could mean a woman's genitals and, in a hunting context, a moment when dogs lose the scent. All of these images are extremely derogatory, reducing this poor mother to a prostitute, or worse, to a dog in heat. And lest we overlook this fact, Edmund is standing right here as his father continues to refer to him only as his mother's son, and then insults that mother. Kent must be very sorry he's involved in this conversation at all, but he says, "I cannot wish the fault undone, the issue of it being so proper." Kent reverts to a fault with the meaning of a mistake or a sin. since there's such a clear sense of this young man having been conceived with someone other than Gloucester's wife. But he sidetracks Gloucester's bawdy comments and suggests that there can't have been much harm since the young man has turned out so well. He's faultless, or proper. Earnestly, he ends with that word, proper, perhaps a hint that Gloucester's tone is inappropriate for where they are. Gloucester, deaf to all comments, continues. But I have, sir, a son by order of law, some year elder than this, who yet is no dearer in my account. Though this knave came something saucily into the world before he was sent for, yet was his mother fair. There was good sport at his making, and the whoreson must be acknowledged. Do you know this noble gentleman, Edmund? Gloucester explains that he has another son, too, one that is about a year older, whom he loves just as much as he loves Edmund. Even though Edmund, the rascal, arrived in the world before he was sent for. But, Gloucester says, his mother was beautiful, and he enjoyed the process of his son's conception, and so the whoreson must be acknowledged. He does have to let people know that Edmund is his son, and he will introduce him now. Whoreson is another awful choice of word. Perhaps Edmund is a literal son of a whore, but certainly it's not something you want to be called by your own father. Again, at court. Gloucester really isn't endearing himself to us here. He's just confessed that he has a slightly older, legitimate son. We will eventually learn that he is Edgar, and that while Edgar's mother was recuperating from her pregnancy, Gloucester was out cavorting with prostitutes, explaining Edmund's saucy arrival in the world. And now the poor young man is introduced thus, and asks if he knows this noble gentleman, Kent. He says, "No, my lord." I love that the first word Edmund says is no, and you'll see why as we go along. Gloucester continues the introduction, explaining to Edmund that this is my lord of Kent. Remember him hereafter as my honourable friend. So he's telling Edmund to remember Kent. We've no indication that the two men are actual friends. Who would even want to be Gloucester's friend after this introduction from Shakespeare? But Edmund is polite and says, my services to your lordship. Kent responds in kind. I must love you and sue to know you better. This is a nice thing to say. As the son of my friend, I hope to get to know you better. And Edmund replies, sir, I shall study deserving. He shall do his best to be worthy of this kind behaviour. It's all very cordial. And in case you're wondering why Edmund doesn't already know people at this court, Gloucester explains. He hath been out 9 years, and away he shall again. Edmund has apparently been away, or out, for 9 years. Just as Hamlet left Elsinore for Wittenberg, perhaps Edmund has been away somewhere at university, or, more simply, perhaps he was sent to be raised at another household. Given how much Gloucester is talking about his illegitimacy, it might have been a relief for Edmund to grow up elsewhere. But he's back now, even if Gloucester is saying that he's soon to be departing again, but before he does, he's going to make a name for himself. Without any more ado, however, Gloucester announces, the king is coming. We are about to have a big event at court, but we will save Lear's arrival and his darker purposes for the next episode. I have to say, I am delighted to be starting this play, and I hope you're going to enjoy it. The website is going to get a little makeover in the coming days, now that I will have to divide it in three, like Lear's Kingdom, for you to access the pages relating separately to Hamlet, Macbeth, and now King Lear. It should certainly be sorted by the time I upload the next episode next weekend, but do please visit at thehamletpodcast.com. I hope that 2024 is treating you very well already, and I'll speak to you next time.